My name is Anthony Freud. I'm the General Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and today I would like to speak to you about Franz Lehár's most famous operetta, The Merry Widow. Courtesy of Warner Classics, we'll be playing excerpts from the celebrated recording featuring Elisabeth Schwarzkopf as Hannah, Eberhard Wächter as Danilo, Josef Knapp as Baron Zeta, Nikolai Gedda as Camille, and Hanni Stefek as Valenciennes. Lovro von Matačić conducts the Philharmonia Chorus and Orchestra. And special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. You've probably guessed that that is not from Richard Strauss's Salome, although both premiered in 1905. What gave it away? The tambourines? The tamburici, a type of lute popular in Hungary, Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia? The chorus shouting hey at the end of the refrain? Or the fact that everyone seems to be having fun? That was the Csárdás from Act II of Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow. A csárdás is a traditional Hungarian folk dance, and the surprising change in tempo is a central feature of the form. The word means tavern, so yes, there was drinking involved. The csárdás was also used by the Hungarian army in the 18th century as a recruiting tool. I'm guessing that waking up the next morning in the army was less fun than the advertising led you to believe. Comedian Viktor Borger described the Hungarian csárdás as something like a polka if you limp a little. If you couldn't make out all of the words, by the way, that's because some of them are in Bosnic or Bosnian. A lot of Merry Widow librettos don't translate that line. No doubt they think it's like Gilbert and Sullivan's made-up Japanese. The chorus is singing, "We like to have fun." And while I'm going to talk to you about some of the history of Lehár's operetta and the many wonderful musical numbers, that one line sums up the piece. It's fun and it's funny. Operetta has become a generic term, but the number of real operettas any of us can name is relatively small. Die Fledermaus by Johann Strauss Jr. Seemingly everything Jacques Offenbach wrote, except the one that actually gets performed, The Tales of Hoffmann. Most of the works of Gilbert and Sullivan. The operetta repertoire is owned by four composers, Offenbach, Sullivan, Strauss, and Lehár. But Emmerich Kallmann, Alexandre Lecoq, and Franz von Suppé also made their names in it. Notice that every one of those men is strongly associated with one of only three cities. Sullivan was born and worked in London, Lecoq and Offenbach lived and worked in Paris, Kallmann, Strauss, Lehár and von Suppé were in Vienna. All three cities are European cosmopolitan capital cities, and all had large populations looking for entertainment. There are many other comic musical dramatic forms, Italian opera buffa, French opera comique, German Singspiel, and later American musicals. But none had operetta's combination of light, topical, and often political satire. Operetta, because of its history, is a Parisian and later a Viennese form. Paris was first on the scene with vaudeville, satires originally given at street fairs. These pieces took existing well-known songs and wrote new words to them, making fun of contemporary politicians, society, and stuffy institutions. As the form gained popularity, it moved indoors and attracted a young generation of composers who composed original, though no less popular, tunes. Two new musical forms emerged: the opéra comique, which borrowed from vaudeville the practice of alternating musical numbers and spoken dialogue. Housed in a new theatre named appropriately the Opéra Comique, these pieces were not necessarily satirical or even funny. The best-known opéra comique today is Georges Bizet's Carmen. The recitative one sometimes hears in performances of Carmen was written after the composer's death so that the piece could be presented as a French grand opera. Operetta, or in French, opérette, also incorporated spoken dialogue, but it retained the farcical nature of the original vaudeville. Offenbach's enormously successful career established the genre, and he produced his works in a variety of small theatres in and around Paris. His best known were Orphée aux Enfers, Orpheus in the Underworld, La Belle Hélène, The Beautiful Helen, La Vie Parisienne, Parisian Life, La Grande Duchesse de Gerolstein, and La Péricole. There is an assumption that light opera is a lesser form than grand opera, and the fact that these works are now seldom performed is given as supporting evidence of their inferiority. But the form itself limited its portability. Offenbach was parodying people and institutions of his time, France's Second Empire. When one presents Belle Hélène today, for example, it has to be translated not just from French, but also from 1860s Paris. Gilbert and Sullivan are popular with contemporary audiences, but even Gilbert's libretti need program notes explaining some of the jokes. There is another reason for the assertion that operetta is less significant than its unamusing counterparts. Over his entire career, Wagner premiered a dozen or so works for the stage. Offenbach premiered nearly 100. Operettas were not only topical, they were perishable. The original vaudeville used pre-existing music because they were intended to satirize today's headlines. There would be another tomorrow. They were produced in small, low-budget theatres, and those working on them, including the composers, got paid when they produced. Making a living was for many composers more about quantity than quality. It's not accidental that Offenbach, Johann Strauss Jr., and Sullivan, the three pillars of this repertoire, were not significant orchestrators. They dashed off wonderful tunes set to simple, quick orchestrations. There was simply no time to compose, copy, or rehearse difficult orchestrations like those of Hector Berlioz. Composer Camille Saint-Saëns wrote that operetta is, quote, the daughter of opéra comique who went astray, unquote. The audiences wanted to be entertained, not challenged, a fact that even Saint-Saëns could not bring himself to condemn entirely. Daughters who go astray are not always without their charms, he added. Viennese operetta grew from the Parisian tradition, and like the French form, was largely the work of one man, Johann Strauss Jr. The son of Vienna's most famous dance band leader, Johann Strauss Sr., Jr. added a new element to the operetta form, the waltz. This was a musical form he had heard from birth. Strauss Sr. had made himself famous and rich by forming an orchestra to capitalize on the increasing popularity of public balls. The public paid fees to spend the evening dancing to the latest popular tunes, and Strauss Sr.'s waltzes were some of the most popular. A shrewd businessman, Strauss Sr. started naming his waltzes so that when his patrons went to the music store the next morning, they could correctly identify the piece they had heard the night before. Strauss Sr. wanted his son to be a banker, but Jr. was more interested in the family business, and the two ended up as professional rivals. It would be Jr. who would go down in history as the waltz king. His roughly 500 waltzes and other dances included The Blue Danube, Tales from the Vienna Woods, and the waltzes for Wiener Blut and Die Fledermaus. The waltz was also uniquely associated with the city of Vienna, then capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Having started as a folk dance, the waltz took Europe by storm in the 19th century. It was not stately and it was not conservative. The waltz was sexy and risque, with partners dancing so close together that it scandalized contemporary moralists. The team that produced The Merry Widow had grown up in the tradition established by Johann Strauss. Composer Franz Lehár was the son of a bandmaster in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Victor Leon and Leo Stein were professional operetta librettists, both men having written scripts for Strauss, among others. For The Merry Widow, this team used a play by the Parisian-born playwright Henri Meilhac, who had himself written the librettos for Bizet's Carmen and Offenbach's best-known operettas. Hannah Glavary, the heroine, is the widow of a rich Pontevedrian banker. She's living in Paris and looking for fun. The country of Pontevedro is, like the Duchy of Grand Fenwick in The Mouse That Roared, a small, remote place full of colourful local tradition, and therefore inherently comical. Pontevedro is also insolvent. If Hannah marries a foreigner, Pontevedro will go bankrupt, and it's therefore up to the Pontevedrian ambassador in Paris, Baron Zeta, to see that this does not happen. By setting his Viennese confection in Paris, Léhard touched both homes of the operetta tradition. But he also incorporated the political satire common to the form. Pontevedro's ambassador in Paris is Baron Mirko Zeta. Zeta's first secretary is Count Danilo Danilovich. The embassy secretary is Niegush. Léhard might have lifted the names out of the Wikipedia entry for another Balkan state, had Wikipedia existed when the operetta premiered in 1905. In that year, Montenegro was an independent principality in Eastern Europe, surrounded by Serbia, Bosnia, and the Ottoman Empire. Among its medieval antecedents was the Kingdom of Zeta. It had been ruled by the Petrovich-Njeguš dynasty since 1696, and one of its most important leaders was Danilo Petrovich Njeguš, who ruled as Danilo I, Prince of Montenegro, from 1852 to 1860. The obviousness of the reference was a political embarrassment when the work premiered in London in 1907, so the translator changed all the names. And this was before the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914 on Montenegro's border that would set off World War I. In 1905, it was still safe to think of Montenegro as, if not a banana republic, then a banana dictatorship, more associated with quaint customs than violence and suffering. The Merry Widow originally began without an overture, although this was presumably unrelated to Pontevedro's lack of ready cash. The Merry Widow's success would make Léhard an international celebrity. The composer wrote the overture 35 years after the premiere for a performance given by the Vienna Philharmonic in 1940 to celebrate his 70th birthday. The operetta also begins without a hero, since First Secretary Count Danilo Danilovich is off at Maxim's, the real and famous Parisian nightclub and restaurant on the Rue Royale. In addition to the décor, Maxim's was known for its stylish clientele. Jean Cocteau, writing in 1913, complained that it was an accumulation of velvet, lace, ribbons, diamonds, and what all else I couldn't describe. To undress one of these women is like an outing that calls for 3 weeks' advance notice. It's like moving a house. Which did not discourage Cocteau from spending time there. Baron Zeta is throwing a party for Hannah at the embassy. Danilo is fetched from Maxim's by Niegush, and Zeta orders Danilo to marry Hannah for the sake of the fatherland. Danilo, however, wants to forget the fatherland, which he's been doing with the help of the grisette, the showgirls who inhabit Maxim's.
Da geh ich zu Maxim, dort bin ich sehr intim. Ich duze alle Damen, ruf sie beim großen Namen. La la da da, chuchu, klock klock, Margot. Sie lassen mich vergessen, das teure Vaterland.
The Lolo, Dodo, Juju, Clo-Clo, Margot and Frou-Frou, he mentions, are his grisette friends. Danilo does not want to marry Hannah because he's in love with her. Or rather, they were in love with each other and planned to marry until Danilo's uncle put a stop to the marriage because Hannah had no money of her own. Now that Hannah is rich and widowed, Danilo refuses to marry her as a point of honour. And Hannah says she will not marry him until he admits he loves her. Distracted by these high matters of state, Baron Zeta fails to notice that his own wife, Valenciennes, is being wooed by Count Camille de Roussillon. Camille is a French officer and a flirt, but some printed versions of the score also list him as the French attaché to the embassy. An attaché is a member of the embassy staff, usually with a particular area of expertise, a military attaché or a cultural attaché. If this designation is correct, it implies that the Pontevedrian embassy is so deficient in knowledge of the local culture that it felt the need for a specialist, perhaps to help staff find their way around the métro. But this may simply be one of the mistakes that have been made during the many rewrites of the work done over the years to keep it topical. There's no mention of his title in the dialogue, so the joke would only be appreciated by the performers. The names of the grisette have also changed from time to time, perhaps when they were off appearing in other operas. Camille writes "I love you" on Valenciennes' fan, but she loves her husband and is not interested in Camille. Unfortunately, during the party, Valenciennes' fan ends up in the hands of another diplomat, Kromoff, who thinks it belongs to his own wife. He gives it to the ambassador, who incorrectly returns it to Kromoff's wife. The Lady's Choice dance now begins. Danilo may be unwilling to marry Hannah himself, but as a good son of the fatherland, he has promised to help Zeta marry her to a Pontevedrian. Meanwhile, Valenciennes hopes Camille will woo Hannah so she can be rid of him. Hannah chooses Danilo, who ungallantly offers to sell the dance for 10,000 francs. When no one meets his price, Danilo decides to dance with Hannah. But having been publicly humiliated, Hannah is no longer interested. The act ends with Danilo dancing alone to the inevitable waltz, until Hannah relents and falls into his arms. Is set in Hannah's house in Paris, where she's throwing a party in honour of the birthday of the Grand Duke of Pontevedro. It is here that the chardash is performed by the guests, who are dressed in traditional Pontevedrian clothing. Hannah entertains the guests with her own folk song, Vilia, one of the most famous tunes Leha composed. Baron Zeta is worried about Camille, whom he fears has designs on Hannah. He therefore orders Danilo to find out who owns the incriminating fan, thinking that he can use it against Camille. Hannah sees the fan and thinks it is Danilo's way of declaring his love for her, but he denies it. Danilo leaves the fan behind to be discovered by Camille, who is wooing Valenciennes in the pavilion, still without success. He asks if he can keep her fan, and she agrees, but only after writing, "I am a highly respectable wife," underneath his declaration of love. Zeta, Danilo and Niegush arrive, having previously arranged to meet in the pavilion, but it is locked. Zeta looks through the keyhole and sees his wife, Valenciennes. While the Baron tries to decide what to do, Niegush smuggles Camille out of the pavilion and Hannah in, so that when the door is finally opened, it appears that Camille was wooing not Valenciennes, but the Merry Widow herself. Hannah tells the assembled guests that she is going to marry Camille. Furious, Danilo storms off to Maxime's, inadvertently revealing his true feelings to Hannah, and leaving her the only happy person on stage as Act Two concludes. Act Three is set in Hannah's ballroom, which she has decorated to look like Maxime's in tribute to Danilo. She has even hired Maxime's grisette for the evening. Danilo has gone to the real Maxime's, but finding it empty, has come to Hannah's party. He tells her that for the good of Pontevedro, she must not marry Camille, and is delighted when Hannah explains that she has no intention of doing so. She was simply protecting the reputation of a married woman. Danilo wants to declare his own love for Hannah, but is stopped by thoughts of her fabulous wealth. Zeta now realizes that the fan belongs to his own wife, Valenciennes, and declares he will divorce her and marry Hannah. That won't work, Hannah tells him, as she will forfeit her fortune if she ever remarries. Danilo is overjoyed to hear this and proposes on the spot. Hannah accepts, laughingly explaining that she loses her fortune because by law it becomes the property of her new husband. Zeta and Valenciennes reconcile, and the operetta ends with everyone agreeing that men won't ever understand women.
Niemals kennt doch an Ziele und Leid, man das weiß.